The Helicaster Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HelicasterJane.com.
I was a highwayman. Along the coach roads I did ride, with sword and pistol by my side. A young maid lost her baubles to my trade. Many a soldier shed his lifeblood on my blade. The bastards hung me in the spring of 25, but I am still alive.
Of Willie Nelson, singing his part as one of the epic members of the epic quartet of star power that comprised that force of nature that included Nelson, Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings, and Kris Kristofferson, the pioneering outlaw country music supergroup, the Highwaymen. Today on the Helicaster Jane Show, we take a look at the Highwaymen and the men who are its members. Joining me at my table is four-time Emmy-winning Jim Brown, producer, director, writer, and cinematographer, to talk about his new documentary, American Masters, The Highwaymen, Friends Till the End, airing on your PBS stations Friday, May 27th, 9 p.m. Eastern. And in our second half hour, the delightful Terry Jennings, the oldest son of Waylon Jennings, author of Waylon, Tales of My Outlaw Dad. We'll be back with my guests in a minute. But first, welcome. I am your host, Helicaster Jane. The Helicaster Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by visiting my website at HelicasterJane.com and clicking on the Audible.com icon for your free book. Hey, what's more fun than a free book? And while you're there, explore our ads and support the show with a click on the links. We want to welcome our new partner, our favorite store, the finest in offering gourmet foods, Dean and DeLuca. And remember, the Helicaster Jane Show is always available online at HelicasterJane.com and a host of venues including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, SoundCloud, the iHeartRadio Network, and at our newest home on Google Play Music. Four-time Emmy Award-winning producer, director, writer, and cinematographer Jim Brown is responsible for some of the most popular and critically acclaimed musical documentary programs of the last four decades. Listen to just some of the documentaries he's created. 50 Years with Peter, Paul, and Mary, Billy Joel, A Matter of Trust, The Bridge to Russia, American Masters, Pete Seeger, The Power of Song. The list goes on and on. Never one to rest on his laurels, Brown is back with a new documentary airing on your local PBS stations Friday, May 27th, 9 p.m. Eastern, American Masters, The Highwaymen, Friends Till the End, which features vintage performances, rare behind-the-scenes footage of life on the road, and new interviews with Willie Nelson, Jesse Coulter, John Mellencamp, Toby Keith, and many more. There's a lot to get to. Let's talk. All right, Jim, so this is really some documentary. Really, you did, just hear me, an exquisite job capturing exactly who these men were, are. And as your title says, these friends till the end. You know, this is what something I was thinking when I was watching it. There's something really mystical about friendships between men. Magical, right? Something different than that between women. Was it that deep friendship and the respect that made the Highwaymen the stellar group that they were? I mean, what do you think?
Well, I think that was one of the bonds, you know, was the friendship. That's why they got together. I think what made them stellar is that they were four incredibly talented individualists who were interconnected with each other's careers in ways that we probably didn't know before. And I think also necessity may have had something to do with it. This was occurring during the 80s, and Nashville was changing, and some of the older guys were getting pushed out the door, some of these guys included. And, you know, they just believed in themselves and stuck to their beliefs and their talent, and it paid off.
Before we get into our discussion about them, the group, the Highwaymen, let's talk about Jim Brown. Okay, let's talk about you. Four Emmys, four more Emmy nods, and a host, right?
Yeah. A host
of awards too many to even, it would take up our whole show. I mean, what's the story with you, buddy? That's great. But you focus mostly on music, and I want to know how all of this came about to make Jim Brown Productions. Talk to me.
Okay. Well, I had a very unique path. As a young kid, I worked for Ben Bodkin, who ran the Library of Congress in Washington, their folklife division, for a while. Feeding his cats, by the way, and cutting his lawn. And a few years later than that, I took up guitar, and Peter Tork of the Monkees was my guitar teacher. And a couple years after that, Lee Hayes of the Almanac Singers and the Weavers moved to my town, and I was his gardener and helper, and was playing in bands, and mainly rock bands and a jug band. But got to know Lee and all about Woody Guthrie, and met Pete Seeger, and even played with Pete Seeger at a pretty early age. And basically, Lee was, by the time I went to film school and came out, Lee was pretty sick and wanted to get together with the Weavers one more time. And they did, and it was fantastic. And we captured it in a film called The Weavers Wasn't That a Time. And I think that came out in about 1980. It was probably one of the hit documentaries of the year. It got distributed in a lot of different countries, was televised in a lot of countries. It's been seen on PBS as a fundraiser and broke records. I think it's been on PBS for 30 years. And I was lucky enough to then, that's kind of what I wanted to do, was make films about musicians. And that opened a lot of doors for me, that film that I was close to, because I was close to Pete and Lee and the Weavers, that meant a lot to people that came after them, either for the folk revival or guys like this. Many of the, I would say three of the Highwaymen regarded those guys very highly. And, they, from then on, it just grew. And I've been very lucky to have worked in music so long, and with many of the musicians that were my idols as a younger person, some of them now are my best friends, and I've done, films on them.
Pretty cool, pretty cool, pretty cool. Listen to me, yeah. The Highwaymen, there was enough testosterone on that stage.
Yeah.
I mean, oh my God, right? So going in, I know you never worked with them as a group, but you had worked with them individually. Did you have a vision going in of what you thought it was going to be that may have surprised you when it's all said and done and you do that last edit and it's put to bed? You go, wait, that wasn't what I thought I was going to do. Or maybe that's exactly what I thought I was going to do.
It was pretty close, I got to say, because on a project like this, where it's retrospective and, there was only a limited amount of material, I wanted to definitely build a film about their friendship and their music, and also give glimpses of each of them as an individual, just like their concerts did. You know, the concerts played the hits of the Highwaymen, but also played the hits of Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, and Kris Kristofferson. So you got a great mix. And I had looked at the archival materials enough before starting that I kind of saw a path through that. And then from that point on, it was like being admitted to this great family. You know, there was so much love between the families, and it really was kind of a family affair. All the families went out on tour. The band was a super band of studio musicians that never toured. The guys were very friendly with each other and had all these different relationships based on songwriting or performing together. And it was so full of love and admiration. I think if you had asked any of the Highwaymen at any point after the Highwaymen started, what was the high point or the happiest point of your career, they would say performing with the Highwaymen, because those guys were were our friends. And they just had a ball. What was described to me was like a dream for most musicians, and especially guys at midlife. It was kind of like all of a sudden having a shot at something very big again, and they accomplished that.
Yeah, that's so interesting. At the time that they got together, most of them had already didn't have contracts at that point, right?
Well, they were all huge stars at some point. But in the mid-80s, the system in Nashville was changing, and they were looking for younger talent to bring in, probably so they could exploit them more. They were more exploitable. And these guys, you know, look at Willie today, 82 and 2 number one records, one in country and one in jazz past 12 months. These guys didn't believe in that kind of stuff. And they just believed in setting their own goals and achieving them. And they were able to do that very nicely together. And it was great to watching the concert material. Not only is the music absolutely terrific and it sounds like you're in the recording studio with them, but the guys are funny and they have a great time. And I learned a lot making this film about how strong those ties were and what those ties were that bound them together.
It's interesting. When I was watching the film, I was thinking to myself, Lord knows individually these guys, right? Unbelievable, untouchable, unique, fantastic. But something did happen to them different than what happens maybe with other groups, you know, coming together, other separate artists coming together on a stage. There really was something very magical that they fed off of each other in a way that you don't often see. You can sometimes see a lot of
competition. Well, not only fed off each other, but tried to one-up each other. And again, because they were each megastars in their own right, they were somewhat competitive, I think. And every time they went out, they, like great athletes, they were, you know, trying to do the best they possibly could. And, you know, I don't think there's four individuals that changed country music perhaps as much as these four guys, each in their own way, you know. And also their roots were different. You know, Johnny Cash had come from Sun Records. Waylon Jennings had, you know, started as a rocker with Buddy Holly. Chris has an advanced degree in English literature and was about to teach at West Point before becoming probably the greatest songwriter to hit Nashville. And Willie, who was a very talented musician, had been kind of fed up with Nashville and gone back to Austin and discovered an audience that was kind of a mixture of rednecks and students from Texas University, and played into that and was influenced by not only his idol Django Reinhardt, but all kinds of country artists that he, you know, witnessed during his teenage years in Texas, but also by the rock and roll music that he was hearing around Austin. So each of them were kind of atypical roads into country music and defined it in unique ways.
The story of how it happened in and of itself is kind of odd. Johnny Cash, Switzerland.
Yeah.
I mean, right?
Well, he had an annual Christmas show, and, you know, these were guys that enjoyed the finer things in life, and he thought, well, it'd be great to get a group of my friends and go over to Switzerland, and, you know, maybe the girls can go shopping in Paris on the way or on the way back, and we'll have fun. And I think also he was motivated to start a relationship with Willie. He'd recorded with Waylon and was Waylon's friend, and he was, you know, really very responsible for Chris's early success. So he had relationships with them, and he knew Willie, but he had never recorded with him. And I think he was thinking that if they got together for this Christmas show, maybe something would come out of it. And they sounded so good together during that Christmas show that everybody said, hey, let's do a record. And Chips Moman, who was their producer for The Highwaymen and had produced certainly some of Willie's hits, was there on the Johnny Cash show to help with the sound. And immediately he got into gear. And Marty Stewart, who was playing in Johnny's band at the time because he was married to Johnny's daughter, basically he had heard talk of this song, The Highwaymen, that had four distinct different characters in it, four different parts. And he made a phone call and got actually a Glenn Campbell recording of that Jimmy Webb song. And when Chips Moman and Johnny Cash heard it, I think they, you know, immediately paused and said, wow, that's interesting. And so the group really didn't have a name at that point, and they became the Highwaymen because that song defined them, that really terrific song written by Jimmy Webb.
Absolutely true. I used to hang out with Jimmy Webb at Lucy's Adobe in California. The songs that came out of him, knowing him, unbelievable. There was a dichotomy between who he is and the songs that he wrote. Supergroup, the pioneering outlaw supergroup. Let's focus on that outlaw part of this, because I do think, you know, you mentioned they changed country music. Talk to me about that.
Well, I think that, you know, Waylon had started in Phoenix and was actually playing the Rolling Stones, the Beatles. Of course, he started before that with Buddy Holly as one of the Crickets and gave up his seat the night the music died, on his seat to the Big Bopper, who was feeling a bit sick. But anyway, Waylon was a hit in Phoenix. And Willie had heard him and met him and said, you know, you're making pretty good money here. I don't know if I'd come to Nashville, but Johnny had heard him and said, you should come to Nashville. You write great songs. You have a unique performance style. At that point, the 70s, the Nashville sound was trying to cross over to a large pop audience. And under producers like Chet Atkins and Jerry Bradley, you know, they were using large choruses, string sections, things to make the country music smoother. I don't think these guys came from that ilk. You know, they tried to fit into that system and there just really wasn't traction there. Willie was writing songs. Waylon was having a hard time. Johnny Cash had already become a huge star. And Chris was just on his way to Nashville. After trying for a couple of years, Waylon was able to get New York-based manager that got him and then Willie artistic control of their careers. And before that, when they went to recording sessions, it was the producer, he'd pick the material, or the publisher might pick the material, or the record company might pick the material. But the artists didn't pick the material, the musicians, all they really did was show up and sing. And that did not go well, or nor did it produce really great results for Willie or Waylon. So they had their own vision of what they would do. Waylon brought, I would say, a more guitar rock sounding, guitar driven rock sounding music. They both believed in their bands that they played with and didn't really need studio musicians. And they played things in a more pared down kind of way, and also in a more spontaneous way. And their first, Waylon's first foray into this was Honky Tonk Heroes. Of course, it went gold. Willie soon followed with Redheaded Stranger. It's been on the charts for years and years. And then finally, Jerry Bradley, I think, got the sense that, you know, outlaw music, and they were calling it outlaw music because it lived outside the system. Willie had moved back to Austin, grew his hair long. Waylon was wearing long hair. This was not the clean-cut, polished image of the Nashville sound. And the term outlaw was coined by a PR person, a woman that wrote PR for the Nashville scene. And basically, their records were the first records, Willie's and Waylon's, to go gold and to go platinum. When Willie and Waylon got together on Wanted the Outlaws, which also featured Jesse Coulter and Tom Paul Glaser, that was the first record to go platinum in country music. And actually, one of the biggest songs out of it was Jesse Coulter's I'm Not Lisa. But they took that sound and changed not only the sound of country music, but also the way records were produced. It gave artists much more power and strength after Waylon and Willie had kind of invented the outlaw music system.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty fascinating when you think about it, right? Because everything we are today in country music, really, thanks to them. Supergroup, the Mount Rushmore of country music, big statement. You know, somebody's writing great PR for these guys, except this one really works. This is really true. These guys really are, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they are the Mount Rushmore of country music.
Not only musically, but individually, they were such strong characters,
right?
and truly American characters. You know, they had the Western image behind them. They were a little bit bad at times.
A little.
But also they had great wisdom and were poets and fantastic performers. I was lucky enough to film each of them at different times. And I was always moved by how great they were with their bands and how unique each of them was in their own way, you know.
Yeah, let's talk about them each in their own way. There's something very interesting in this film. Let's talk sex, drugs, mm-hmm. and country music. You know, it's interesting to me, there's a scene in the film, Jennings and Cash both suffering from painful addictions and didn't know that each of the other was getting clean.
Well, it wasn't just in country music, and it wasn't just Cash and
of course.
Jennings. You know, basically, it was pretty hard being a road musician back in the 60s and 70s. Didn't make much money at that point. These guys didn't even have buses for a while. And, you know, you were the band leader. You were the manager, probably. You were the paymaster. And you were the driver. So to find audiences to play, you might drive 1,000 miles one day, play a show, and get back in the car and drive all night to another show. And amphetamines were pretty popular in the music business in general during those years. And I think because of the amount they were touring and the, you know, basically they were all very work-oriented guys. They worked as much as they could. They wanted to grow. They used amphetamines to stay up and not have accidents and to keep going. So I think a lot of people don't understand that part of the drug use. Also, in Johnny's case, there was a lot of pain. But in Waylon's case, it did go to cocaine, which, again, you know, music has been no stranger to cocaine. And I think by the time they were in their 50s, their families had gotten to them and they had tried numerous times to quit, and they did. Waylon kind of went cold turkey out in Arizona. He moved out into a house. He had tried it before. And, you know, again, as a strength of the guy, he did that. Johnny had also kicked his addictions to what now were pain pills and not so much amphetamines, because he had so much pain. And their families were tremendously supportive. And I think they were supportive of one another during that time period.
Yeah.
And as were the other guys in the group.
Christopherson made an assessment of each of them. Here's a quote. Willie's the outlaw coyote. Waylon's the riverboat gambler. I'm the revolutionary communist radical. And John is the father of our country. Right? So if I
That's
say each
good.
Of their names, I'm going to play a game with me. I know you're going to hate this, but just do it. I'd like to hear from you the one word that comes to mind when I say, for instance, Christopherson.
I've got to say it in more than one word. I think he was a true patriot and radical who almost gave up his popularity and career to write the kind of political songs that he was driven to write in the latter part of his career. And one of the best songwriters ever.
Truly. Nelson.
Tremendously talented, charismatic, unique phrasing, unique guitar playing, unique.
Jennings.
Big hearted. I think people saw him as bad, but he was really a sweet man, and you would have to be to maintain a relationship with somebody as sweet as Jesse Coulter.
Cash?
Big, the man in black. You know, chasing songs until the end. Very, very unique for Nashville. Pared down the basics. More of a rocker than we might think. And a true patriot and somebody that always stood up for what was right. I did a biography of Pete Seeger, and he and Cash were close at a time when probably no country music star other than Cash would have had a friendship with Pete Seeger.
There's a scene in the film. Love this scene. Old footage of the gang sitting with war hero singing Cowboy Gene Autry. You knew I had to talk about this one. I cannot tell you how touching that footage is. And eye-opening. Yes, they were big. They were testosterone-filled superstars. But you saw in that footage, I'm telling you, Jim, that they were just little boys, grown tall, going after dreams, and fans of superstars just like the rest of us. Didn't that just tear your heart when you found that footage?
Yeah, well, it was pretty easy to find because Don Was had made a very good film about the Highwaymen during the recording of the last album that he, you know, which he was also the producer on. Wasn't widely seen, but it had great scenes in it. And of course, Don's a genius. And most of the documentary footage comes from that film. And like everybody from that era, I think radio had a tremendous influence. And Gene Autry was the singing cowboy, you know. He went from radio to the silver screen. And like each of these guys, was also pretty good at business and, you know, became a tremendous success in just about everything he did. If there was one cowboy idol that these guys had and shared, it was Gene Autry. And so for them to meet him and work with him a little bit was quite special. I believe Johnny's son had told me that there had been a little bit of a relationship between Gene Autry and Johnny and June before that meeting.
Mm. phenomenal. I hope everybody just for no other scene in the film, because there are many gorgeous scenes, that one is just really unique. Listen to me about this. Christofferson, you did do new interviews with Christofferson and with Willie. Talk to me about Christofferson. A lot of people have asked me about this. How's he doing? You know, there's all this yak about his mental capacity and whether he's remembering things. How did you find him?
Well, Chris is probably the guy that I worked with the most out of the group. I filmed him several times and he narrated a couple of projects with me. But I had not met his wife, Lisa, until I went to Austin for Willie's picnic just prior to starting the filming on this to meet everybody. And again, you know, just when you meet the wives of these guys, you realize how important they were and how they were the glue that held them together. In terms of Chris, I think Chris is very happy, and I think that's partly because he doesn't live in the past and he doesn't live in the future. He lives in the present. And he is calm, amazingly good at telling stories. His long-term memory at the time we interviewed him was terrific. And I think he and Lisa were just, you know, sharing wonderful, wonderful times together, still playing, still performing, and being with their friends and their family. So I think he's a happy guy, probably not happy he has Alzheimer's, but personally, his disposition seemed wonderful.
So I have to tell you something. Some of the most interesting part of your film are the interviews with Jesse and with Lisa and Annie Nelson. That just blew me away. I was so glad you went there with them, because you don't often see that in these kind of documentaries.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that they were deliciously honest, all three of them. Frighteningly, right?
As their husbands. I mean, you know, and as are their husbands. These are people that believe in honesty. I think they're all spiritual to, or were spiritual to some extent. And that has something to do with the honesty. But the wives were very special and a real treat to be in their presence. And that was one of the most enjoyable parts of making the film. It's always great to be in the presence of Willie or Chris. And some of the musicians that played with him are like, you know, Mickey Raphael is a great guy to hang with. Robbie Turner also, you know, those were great moments. But the women are very special. And I think they had secrets into what made each of these guys work and tried to help me by divulging, you know, some of those secrets about their personalities. And I think the biggest secret was that they cared so much about each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Country music, really American music, certainly right now America's most popular music. Listen to some of the titles that came out of these guys: Highwayman, Sunday Morning Coming Down, Folsom Prison Blues, Mamas, Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Cowboys. I want to sing it. Sorry. It's just how it wants to come out of my mouth. Always On My Mind, Me and Bobby McGee. You know, I think these guys are in some ways underappreciated, because you know what? They are our Gershwins. They're our Cole Porters. They're our Carole Kings. These guys produce extraordinary music, right?
Oh, the best. I mean, you know, out of all the projects I've done, I would say, even though I've been friends with many of the people that I've done documentaries with, their music, the Highwaymen's music, and their individual music, the music of Willie, Waylon, Johnny, and Chris, are probably my personal favorites of any of the groups that I've done or individuals that I've done. I can sing many of these songs if I pull out my guitar. So
we can have a hoot, Nanny, you and I, you know, darling.
No, we don't want to do that.
Not in public.
These guys do that part, yeah, exactly.
I hear you. So listen, there's no doubt the Highwaymen were a once-in-a-lifetime group, and they made this magical music together, as did you in your film, by the way. I want to again tell you, everybody, this is just really worth the watch. You know, I asked you when we started the conversation if you had some preconceived notion about what your film was going to be, and you gave us an answer. But I have a question for you that is a variation on that theme.
Uh-huh.
Music's transformative, right?
Yes.
So is making documentaries, or for that matter, radio shows, by the way, sometimes, right? So you lived and breathed these guys for a long time. On Friday, May 27th, 9 p.m. Eastern, and most PBS stations, check your local listings, by the way, your documentary, American Masters, The Highwaymen, Friends Till the End, airs. How did making this film, getting to really know these guys and their world, change you, Jim Brown?
I was very happy making this film, because it was a discovery all the way through. And again, it was like being allowed to come into this family. I have to thank everybody that was involved in it, because they all took time to explain to me what the dynamics were. And so if anything, it's gratitude. You know, I mean, I really enjoy making documentaries and doing concerts. This one was especially a great pleasure. And I, you know, I just, everybody that we worked with was very, very gracious and very, very accommodating. And I think they wanted to make sure that we got it right. You know, the guy that I got to thank the most is probably Mark Rothbaum, who was Willie's manager and Waylon's manager and the manager of the Highwaymen and managed Chris for a time too. And Mark, I think he eyed me suspiciously at the beginning. He said I wasn't an insider, and but I was willing to do the work. And he sat me down many times and said, "This is what happened," and went over my questions with me and said, "You know, you could ask this and maybe get this." I'm very grateful. Not many busy managers would take that kind of time and care. And I found that kind of attitude with everybody, whether, you know, it was a wife, one of the performers, one of the musicians. It was like, well, welcome into this. And this is what we can share about it. And it was great. And we're all very proud about it.
I've been speaking with 4-time Emmy Award-winning producer, director, writer, and cinematographer Jim Brown, whose new documentary, American Masters, The Highwaymen, Friends Till the End, airs on PBS stations nationwide Friday, May 27th, 9 p.m. Eastern. For more information about Jim Brown and his work, visit his website at www.jimbrownproductions.com. And for more about The Highwaymen, Friends Till the End, visit pbs.org/American Masters. There's a new CD, DVD available, The Highwaymen Live, American Outlaws, via Columbia Legacy. You are listening to the Helly Kesser Jane Show. My guests today are Jim Brown, producer, director, writer, and cinematographer, here today to talk about his new documentary, American Masters, The Highwaymen, Friends Till the End, airing on your PBS stations Friday, May 27th, 9 p.m. Eastern. And Terry Jennings, the oldest son of Waylon Jennings, author of Waylon, Tales of My Outlaw Dad. We'll be back in a minute. Stay with us. Terry Jennings is the oldest son of country music legend Waylon Jennings and was born when Waylon was only 19 years old in 1956. A brother, perhaps, more than a son. In his biography of his late father, Waylon, Tales of My Outlaw Dad, Terry speaks to the many roles he played in his father's life, as a buffer against the pitfalls of celebrity, as his drug runner, his liaison between his father and his father's many women. He says sometimes they were like Andy and Opie, sometimes they were Homer and Bart. But always, Terry says of his relationship with his outlaw daddy, they were best friends. Let's talk. So, Terry, so nice to have you here. Thanks for being on the show. Much appreciated.
Nice to be here.
Well, listen to me. This is something. You were given a front row seat to the life and times of, as far as I'm concerned, one of the great country music legends, your dad, Waylon Jennings. You got to see him, warts and all, but you can't get past the intro to your new book, Waylon, Tales of My Outlaw Dad, without knowing that you loved and revered this man. You had some father. I wondered, did you like him? Was he a likable guy?
He was a very likable guy. I loved him. I mean, I don't know too many people that didn't like him. And the people that did like him is because they got on his bad side at one time or another. But no, I mean, he was a joy to be around. And he especially loved kids because of their honesty. You know, they didn't care who he was. They'd just tell him like it was, you know. But no, he was a joy to be around. I loved him.
Listen to me. I cannot imagine being the son of a superstar, or daughter as it would be in my case. I just cannot imagine what pressure that puts on somebody like you. And needless to say, yours was a complex relationship. I couldn't help but wonder why you wrote this book. Was it to set the record straight, or were you looking to somehow reconcile your relationship with your father, or just maybe it was a little bit of both or something else? Talk to me.
Actually, it was a promise made. We were on a flight to a Dallas Cowboy football game and just got talking about this, that, and another, and And I said, you know what I'll do one of these days? I said, I'll just write a book. And he goes, Terry, that's a great idea. He said, you're the only person I know that's been there from the beginning to the end that doesn't, that ain't afraid to tell the truth. So I just felt obligated to do it. And once he died, I started. And then, so that's been years. And once I let go of it and put it in God's hands, it just all just fell right into place. And bless Hotchkiss Books, they're a great publishing company to be with.
How long did it take you to write this? How many years was this thing going on?
I've been working on it for a good 10 years.
Wow. Wow.
But, you know, I started out in a dark place, and I just, it was mostly me just telling everybody what I thought about them. And, you know, it's like, who wants to read a book about hate, you know? And so, like I said, once I gave it to God and we started coming from different angles, it just really came out great, and I'm proud of it.
What did you mean by you started out in a dark place? Was it after you lost him, you mean?
Well, yeah, you know, after he died, I was still ill, you know, and on a lot of medication, so... You know, trying to write something decent under those circumstances was not the best of all circumstances to be doing it in.
You want to talk about that a little bit more for people who don't know that story?
Well, in 98, I was diagnosed with hepatitis C. Now, I've since been cured, praise God. And they had me on, I mean, it's in the book, the list of medications they had me on. You know, they had me wheelchair-bound for a while.
Mm.
You know, and then... So that's the dark place I was coming from. And, you know, Dad died, and then my illness continued on for a few years after that till finally, you know, accepted Jesus Christ, my Lord and Savior, and everything turned around. And here I am today to write a book, and doctors keep telling me I'm supposed to be dead.
Well, good thing they were wrong, because I got to read this really terrific book of yours, as I hope everybody will. Listen to me. You said something. You said Jesus Christ. You said God. We're in 341 minutes, and that's come up a lot. Your dad was a very spiritual man. I'm surprised people don't know that more. He might have been a preacher. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised, too, that people don't realize. I mean, if you listen to some of his songwriting, I mean, it was some raunchy stuff in his drug days, but, you know, he did I Do Believe. And like I said, you know, he was, you know, going to be a Church of Christ preacher at a younger age, but, you know, they don't have instruments in there, so that kind of nicks that. And once he got a hold of a guitar, you know, he thought it was a private thing rather than just, you know, telling people. But me, I think you should tell people, which he did when he wrote the song, I Do Believe.
Right. He grew up in what, in West Texas?
Yeah, Littlefield, Texas, right there in the panhandle, but right 30 miles from Lubbock.
Now, you know, this is interesting to me, Terry. A lot of people grow up in a lot of different parts of America, and they'll say, yeah, like me, I grew up in Englewood, New Jersey. But something is different about West Texas, and particularly different about West Texas and how it affects musicians who come out of West Texas. Certainly, in my mind, and I'm curious to hear what you have to say about this, Texas is a character in your father's play of life, don't you think?
Well, you know, I'm born and raised in Texas, and everything is better in Texas. So. but to answer your question, there's two ways to answer it. Let's take, for instance, Cash, Willie, Dad. If you think of the era they were growing up in, and the conditions, and, you know, just like Dolly Parton in her movie there, you know, they were dirt poor people, you know, so they made their own entertainment, you know, and most of it was guitar playing and piano playing and things like that, you know, and so out of necessity, they did their own thing, and then it hooked Dad, and he went on with it, same with the other guys. Now, today, at the same thing, there ain't a whole lot to do up in West Texas, you know, and if you don't like what's on the radio, you know, you make your own music. So there's a lot of good music comes out of Texas, I will, but there's good music comes out of all parts of the United States, you know, and the good music is the stuff that comes from life, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
If you live it and write it, it's great, you know, but if you try to write it into a box, it works sometimes, but most times it don't.
I think it's about heart. I think it's what's in your heart. If you write or you create anything and you create it from the heart.
Exactly.
That makes it extra special and makes it extra different. But I want to just stay on Texas for a minute, just because I do think, though, that the sound that he created, that's there. It's in there, you know, maybe even more so than maybe Willie or some of the other guys. I was listening to the CD of the Highwaymen all weekend long because they sent me the new thing that's coming out, and it's dynamic. But I'm thinking, I'm going, yeah, you know, just even looking at Waylon, you know, he's a Texas boy born and bred, that's for sure, right? Right.
Yeah. Well, I might be a little biased.
Yes.
But the one thing that I do love about the Highwaymen is when you put those four guys up on stage together, once and for all, everybody gets to see who the real singer is, both lead and backup vocals and harmony.
I hear what you say there, and I think that there's a certain truth to that. We're going to talk about his voice in a minute, but before we do, let me.
I cut these guys down now, but they're
no,
good.
I understand. Right, right. Well, your father. All right, let's talk that voice. Talk to me about that voice. Did he know he had that voice that makes a woman want him to whisper sweet nothings in their ear? I mean, what in the world would that? Did he know it? Did he play it? Did he understand it? It was a gift.
Yes, and yes. No, yeah, I mean, he knew he had a voice, you know, and he developed that from, you know, being a DJ on. And women are drawn to musicians, and Dad kind of dug that. So, yeah, he used it to his advantage, you know.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, the old line, I wrote that song about you, baby.
Smart, I love it. Smart guy, that's for sure. Listen, his story is definitely one for the books, literally. You can't make this stuff up. Reading the genesis of his career was almost as if he was destined for greatness. The kid from Texas that we just talked about, he picks up a guitar at 8, begins performing at 12 on the radio. In 58, Buddy Holly arranged Jennings' first recording session, and when Sin stops, hires him out to play bass. He gives up his seat on the ill-fated flight that crashed and killed Holly and the others the day the music died, we call it, and he called it. Then song after song, album after album, one hit follows the other. The outlaw country movement, Willie Nelson, the Highwaymen, Kris Kristofferson, Johnny Cash. Just listen to this. This is a crazy thing. And let's not forget that he was a balladeer for the Dukes of Hazzard, one of my favorite, composing and singing the show's theme song. But Terry, he lived hard and he died young. He made a lot. He lost a lot. He surely loved his drugs. Question, what drove him?
Yes, when he did them, he did. And, you know, once he quit, you know, he didn't. And I'll tell you, I firmly believe that if he would not have been into the cocaine and the speed and all that other stuff and maybe been into more of the pot thing, he'd still be alive today. Look at Willie. That guy's never going to die.
No, I know. That's
kind of,
yeah.
He did leave a legacy behind him, and nobody really thought about what was happening. But to look at it in hindsight, it is kind of a big wow.
I think that's an understatement.
I didn't see it while it was happening.
Yeah, but here's where I wanted to go. I wanted to say that he lived and he died, lived hard and he died young, and he made a lot and he lost a lot, which I just said. But what drove him? Do you know? Did you figure it out? Was he an insecure man seeking fame and fortune? Was he a man who had a lot to say and music was the best way for him to communicate what he needed to say? Did he have something to prove?
No, I'll tell you what.
Okay.
He told me that by the time he was like 29 years old, he was making a life decision, you know, and he looked back on his life and he goes, I know how to pick cotton and I ain't ever going to do that again. I know how to work in a service station and I ain't going to do that again. And I know how to sing and play guitar. So to him, he was later focused on the music, but the reason he was doing that was to make a better living for his family, you know. So, I mean, he may have missed out on a lot of family things and stuff in the beginning, but he made up for it in the end. So what I'm trying to say is the end justifies the means. But that's what drove him, was just making really good music and, you know, taking care of his family.
If he had to choose between a woman and a guitar, which would he have chosen?
A woman. Well, he chose a guitar. I was playing with you. I've seen him pick a guitar over a woman a few times.
That's a great answer. But, you know, this is the thing. Something you get when you listen to his songs. You get when you follow his career. You get when you even look at that face of his, that gorgeous face of his. You get that there was something dogging him. You know, some devil just nipping at his heels, pushing him forward. Is that something that I'm reading into him, or do you think that that part of what drove him was there, something just nipping at him? He had to be the best at what he did.
You hit the nail on the head right there. He had to be the best at what he did. I mean, his whole career, he did the best he could with what he had at the time. you know, and that's what drove him, is he loved music, you know. And you say, he didn't write all those songs, but he sang them like he wrote them.
Right.
You know, but that's what drove him all the way to the end, is like, hey, I can do better, you know. And, I mean, we spent hours and hours and hours, I mean, days in the studio on one song trying to get it right, you know. I mean, and that's why I didn't like studio time. But, he loved it. He loved the creative process. But he was a perfectionist, and he was always striving for something better.
You know, his songs, you describe them in your book as being about drink and drugs, women, hard-working men, and honky-tonk heroes. They were him. His songs were him. That's, I think, part of the magic of him.
Pretty much.
You know?
I mean, that was the lifestyle he led for many, many, many years.
Did you resent it? I know you didn't get to spend... He got divorced from your mom early on, and then he went on his merry way. And then what? How old were you when you went on the road with him?
I was 15.
Right. So between the time they got divorced, when you were, what, 3 or something? Were you...
4.
4. You didn't see much of him. And then you hook in and you go on the road with him. At first, were you resentful that... he'd picked up and kind of gone on his merry way and left you guys behind, or what?
Now, at 4 years old, it hurt my feelings, but I was never resentful. You know, I mean, he said, I love you. I'll see you again. And all through that time, he would book shows 2 or 3 times a year in the area we were at, come by, see us. We'd go out and see him, you know, no matter where we were living or who we were living with. So, no, there was never any resentment, you know, I mean, he was out there doing his thing. I mean, really, I thought that, you know, at that age, I thought everybody lived like that, you know?
There's a great story in the beginning of the book when you realize that your dad is the superstar that you didn't know, and you guys are watching TV and you're just a little kid. I mean, like I said, being the child of somebody with that kind of, you know, storied career, how did it affect you?
Well, I lived. Well, I mean, it made me the person I am today, you know, so, I mean.
So you have no regrets.
Right.
You have no regrets.
I have no regrets whatsoever. If I had to do it over again, I'd do it again.
See, that's a good thing. So about this career of his, you know, it's interesting. If I had to choose a song of his as my favorite, I'm not sure that I could. Or which part of his career, looking back, is the most, you know, titillating, exciting, fabulous, whatever. Certainly the Highwaymen concerts, that's a pretty strong collaboration, needless to say. What was his favorite part of his career?
What was his favorite part of his career? That's a really hard question. I mean, the outlaw era, of course, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then once he got through that and looked back on it, he goes, man, I was nuts. And, you know, I mean, you got to go to Arizona. I mean, that's where he honed his craft, really. And out there at JD's, he spoke, you know, often of that, and, you know. So
I wonder I was going to say, I wonder if we had him here with us right now, and we said to him, did you like the beginning, the middle, or the end? You know, which part? You know, Arizona was the beginning. Maybe we all hold on to that beginning when it's still young and it's still new and it's still pure before all the crap.
I told you a little bit of each.
You think so?
Yeah, I know so.
I love it. I love it. I love it.
You know, that would have been wit coming out of his mouth, and that probably would have been what left it.
Let's get back to my favorite part, the women. This is interesting to me, and I want you to answer this for me. Well, I find it fascinating. I really do. I mean, I find it, it says a lot about a man. He had all the, he had women, you know, he had wives. He would send you out sometimes to get drugs to bring back while he was coercing, having fun with women. You talk about that in the book. Okay.
Yeah.
But at the bottom line, after I read all of this and researched, he really was a man's man. He wasn't a woman's man. He was a man's man.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, if I can become half the man he was, I'm great, you know, and I'm working on it. I mean, he was a man's man, and, you know, he was the alpha male in the room. And, you know, sometimes when you got the Highwaymen together, you had a bunch of alpha males, but they had known each other so long, they knew how to get along to get with each other, but they'd still get each other's goat just for the heck of it.
So what was it about women, do you think? Did you figure that part out? Why he was, you know, it was just because he had just a lust, as that's who he was, or was that something in his childhood that sent him off on that, or that just kind of goes with the territory, you know, being the super, you know, star? What was that about? Do you know?
Well, he once wrote, you know, I've loved women since I found out they weren't men. But, you know, I mean, they were there, and they're, you know, every race, creed, color, and economic status, that you name it. And but we pretty much brought the party to town on 45 foot of Screaming Eagle, so it wasn't like that nobody knew we weren't coming to party, and they weren't too disappointed in joining us.
So listen to me, kiddo, on the road. They're a story. Women throwing their undies at him. I mean, oh, my God. But you were on the road with him all those years.
All days.
Yeah. Talk to me about this. Tell me your favorite story of on the road. Do you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite story on the road?
Yeah.
Let's see here. I guess my favorite story on the road would be the Lynyrd Skynyrd story, which is in the book. We, you know, we were playing in California. They were playing in L.A. We were playing in L.A., different venues. And we both had to come out to do this Willie thing in Tulsa. And then the next day, they were playing Oakland Coliseum, and we were playing the Star Amphitheater right outside of San Francisco. Well, on the plane down there, they announced over the phone, that they, over the PA, that there was a poker game up front. Well, Dad knew I knew how to play poker and enjoy it, so he looked at me, and I nodded, and he said, how much? And I said, well, I got some, so give me 500. And the road manager gave me 500, and I went up there, and they wouldn't let me in their game. And so I pitched a fit, and Deacon drugged me back there and said, don't start anything on the way down here. We'll take care of it on the way back. And since then, I've been on Twitter, and their old road manager messaged me through Twitter and told me, he said, you know, he told me about that story, and he said, that's the only time that they've ever been scared. But God bless them. I mean, it was a month later, their plane fell, and, you know, don't want to hear anybody die or anything, so I forgive them, and I still like to play poker with them, though.
Maybe one day you'll have the chance. What can I tell you, right? There you go. I want to talk to you about his fight with Nashville and the music business in this respect, because we all know that. We all know he went to town and, you know, said, I'm going to do it my way, and they bought into it, and he changed the music industry in Nashville, that's for sure. But what do you think he would think of the music industry today?
I think he would love it today. I mean, I tell you what, when Dad first came to town, they had him as folk country, you know. Then they had him as traditional country. Then they decided he was contemporary country. I mean, all these labels are still just country music, you know, and people like, if they like it, they buy it. If they don't, they don't buy it. Apparently, people are liking what they're hearing today. They're buying a lot of the records. And so I think Dad would be proud of a lot of them that are, you know, out there doing it their way. And you know, music goes in 20-year circles. You know, it all comes back around to the same thing eventually. And the kids think it's something new.
Right. That is true. That's a fact. So listen, I just lost my mom. Losing a parent, that's a complicated, tough thing to deal with. You're so proud of your dad in so many ways, but you lost him when he was very young. He was, what, 65 when he passed away? I think that's, yeah. I was doing the math. But here's the deal. I was wondering if you ever look up at heaven and just scream, you son of a, why'd you leave me so young? And why'd you blow your body apart with all that crap all those years so that you're not with me now? Do you ever just rail at him, talk to him in heaven?
I have in the past, but I'm over it now.
I mean, you are. You're accepting.
I mean, everything you just said, every emotion, you know, it, I don't know, there's the whatever emotions of grief, and anger is one of them, and I spend a lot of time in that one, but I'm glad I'm out of it.
Yeah, I hear you. Listen to me. He had a tough ending. There's no question about it. I mean, you know, the heart failed, and he had diabetes. I think he had a foot amputated. It was just not pretty at the end for him. How did he deal with it? When he knew it was almost over, what was his attitude?
Well, during that period of time, I was more talking through Jesse than to talking directly to him.
Yeah. Because tell everybody who Jesse is, his wife.
Yes, Jesse's, you know, wife all the way to the end.
Right.
But anyway, but he also sent some telegrams, I should say Western Union telegrams.
Remember those
back and forth, and he was always holding out hope, you know. You know, it seemed to me, you know, I was fighting my battle in Texas and he was fighting his in Arizona, and really neither one of us knew how serious each other was, but which I think was for the best because it only stressed him out and me.
Right.
No, it wasn't a pretty ending, but Shooter was the best. You know, after they cut his leg off, you know, he was getting him all hyped up for his next tour. He says, here's what we're going to do. He says, we're going to get you one of those prosthetic legs. And we're going to get a flying W that's got a light that lights up and it moves up and down the rod. You know, and Dad was loving this stuff. <You
know? laughs> He had a sense of humor, that's for sure. If he were alive today, what is the one question you'd want to ask him? Is there any unfinished business between the two? You can tell us the truth. Nobody's listening.
We have no unfinished business, but if he's here today, I'd say, do you believe that what's going on today as far as you? Because for him to be as relevant as he is today, this many years after his death, I never thunk it. I know he didn't.
What's the one thing you wish you could tell him?
I love him one more time.
Hmm.
And I'm proud of him. And, you know, a great dad a man could have.
There's no question he was a man, a talented man, troubled maybe a little bit more than the rest of us, or a little than less than some of us. He was a good man, though, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was. You know, I tell people, you know, that we wore many hats. You know, we had our father's son hat. We had our boss employee hat. We had our almost like brother's hat. And we knew when to wear the hat and when not to. And that's what kept, you know, got us along through everything. And, you know, we hit heads a few times, but we always got over it. Loved the man to death. I wish he was still here today.
I'll bet you do. But he is in so many ways. He was a kid.
I got YouTube.
That's the thing, you know.
And I've got a new documentary coming up to watch on PBS.
Exactly, exactly. So he lives on in spirit, if no one, and in what video. He was a kid from Texas, made good and bad. But no matter what one might have thought about him personally, you could not ignore the giant talent that he was as singer, songwriter, guitarist, or that he loved his wine, women, and drugs. Question, out of it all, what part of the legend do you hate the most? What part is more legend than truth?
The part of legend is, the biggest myth is that Dad was some big drinking badass that running around looking for fights, wanting to beat people up. You know, I mean, Dad was not a fighter. One of his famous lines was, he'd somebody get mad at him. He goes, look, I've had my butt kicked 52 times. Do you want to be 53? And by the time the guy figured out what he said, they were friends, you know? And so, you know, just, I hope that answers your question. I lost him.
No. What I was saying was that, you know, how much of the legend that you didn't like.
That's the part right there. Because Dad wasn't a drinker, and he wasn't a fighter. You know, I mean, he was like a big teddy bear that could bite you. He didn't go out looking to bite you, but if you got bit, you pretty much had it coming, you know. But the fact that people think that he's out there drunk and doing this and all that, I mean, back then people would say, man, he put on a great show, but he surely seemed drunk. Well, we went with that. What we're going to say? No, he wasn't drunk. He was on cocaine, you know.
Right.
It's like, you know, y'all want to think of that? Great.
This is my last thing I want to ask you about, because time marches on. And as we both said, you know, you can listen to his music. You can watch him on YouTube. You can see him in the PBS special. All of that is true. I wonder now, these many years later, as you watch the legend grow, right? Do you think he'd be happy with the way the story is playing out?
Yes, I do. With the way the story is playing out with, like, the PBS special and things like that. But, you know, there's some people out there that never knew Dad that try to say things, you know, this, that, and another. And, you know, I don't agree with that, you know. But, no, he would be very glad with, you know, with what Jim's done with his documentary, you know, and with how his legacy's been handled all the while.
I've been speaking with Terry Jennings. His book, by way of Hachette Book Group, is Waylon, Tales of My Outlaw Dad. Waylon Jennings once said that Nashville is hard on the living, but they speak well of the dead. In Waylon Jennings' case, the accolades are well deserved. To purchase Terry's book, visit Amazon.com. Thanks so much for tuning in to the LA Cancer Jane Show, a production of RESEC LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit LAKesserJane.com.